Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
This is Aaron Weinacht, and I'm here with the Russian and Eurasian Studies section of the New Books Network today, and I'm talking to James White with regard to his new book on history of Russian religion. It's called Unity and Faith, and it's about the interplay between Russian Orthodoxy and old belief and a kind of middle way that emerged called the Yedinoverie. So thank you very much for being with us today, Dr. White.
No, thank you very much for having me, Aaron.
Yep. So could you start off by telling us a bit about yourself, if you could? And where you went to school and how you got interested in Russian history, kind of the background on how you came to write this particular book.
Yeah, sure. So I did my MA and BA at the University of Birmingham in the United Kingdom. And then I went to Florence to the European University Institute to do my PhD. This is when I came up with the idea for the book. The book is based on my PhD thesis. I think it was because largely I was moving away from intellectual history at the time and wanting to do something more, something more connected with social history. And I found that religious history was a sort of perfect melding between the two, between looking at sort of theological ideas and their connections between religious behaviors. And I was also very interested in this notion of religious toleration in the Russian Empire. And I found that Yedinoverie is a perfect case study for this because it's a lot of extremely long case study of the Russian church trying to incorporate ideas surrounding religious toleration and not quite succeeding. At the moment, I'm a senior research fellow at Ural Federal University and a research fellow at the University of Tartu.
Yeah, thank you. I think that because this is a subject that not too many people know very much about ahead of time, I'm thinking that the best thing we could do is go back and talk a bit about the schism in between Orthodoxy and old belief. So could you provide listeners with some broad background context to that?
Absolutely. So in the middle of the 17th century, so in the 1650s, Patriarch Nikon essentially launched a series of ritual reforms. Possibly the most symbolic of these was the changing of the number of fingers used to make the sign of the cross, along with the spelling of Jesus, the direction around which people processed around the church, and so on and so forth. These ritual reforms provoked a great deal of resistance among the laity and also the large portions of the priesthood. However, Nikon and then Tsar Alexei persisted with the reforms in the Moscow Council of 1666. The old believers and their rituals were cast out of the church. Anathema was declared on them. And from that point onwards, they became regarded as schismatics. So they were hunted and persecuted by the church and the state in the initial period of their existence for the rest of the 17th century. And then for the rest of the imperial period, the government policy tended to swing wildly between periods of toleration and periods of persecution. And there were various efforts to try and resolve this schism, both through, as I've mentioned, police tactics, police duties, but but also through missionary outreach. And Yedinaya Velia is an example of a sustained missionary project.
So what was, again, kind of thinking about the broad background here, like what was the basic reasons behind those reforms to begin with? I mean, what was it that caused Nikon and others to say, you know, we should change the number of fingers and so on?
Sure. To a large extent, there was a great deal of reformist zeal in the 1640s in the Russian Orthodox Church. Many had observed the crises earlier in the century, the crises that continued in Russia at that point, and came to the resolution as well. You know, God, for some reason, was abandoning Russia and decided to try and find the reason for this, to try and reform not only liturgical behavior, but also morality and so on and so forth, increased levels of piety. And one conclusion that Nikon came to was he compared the rituals of the Russian church with those being used, apparently, allegedly, by the Greek church. And they concluded that the Greek rituals were older, which meant that the Russian ritual corruption had entered into the Russian rituals. So therefore, it was decided that in order to improve behavior, improve piety, and so on and so forth, there was a need to restore these antique Greek rituals. Of course, this connects with the way Orthodoxy typically portrays itself as the most ancient Christian faith, a Christian faith that's been unblemished by change since the ecumenical councils in the early centuries of Christianity.
So what were the arguments then of the old believers, that rejected those things? Like what form did those arguments take in the, you know, kind of the immediate period of change?
Well, for many, there was a great deal of xenophobia behind it. So the idea that the Greek rituals were somehow were foreign and not Russian, therefore should be rejected out of hand. For many, to be told that they're not only they, but their fathers, their grandfathers, their great-grandfathers, and so on and so forth, had been performing the rites not only simply in the wrong way, but in a way that potentially contaminated them with sin, was, of course, an argument that didn't please many. This was also combined with a sort of time of great social economic upheaval, failed crop failures, a long period of war with the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. All of this combined together to form a potent reason for resistance to religious authority in the Russian Empire, in the Muscovite state, rather. And so this all came together into the concoction which became old belief.
Hmm. Is just curious then, because obviously in the mid-1600s, there's a good bit of religious conflict over what's small Orthodox and what isn't in Western Europe as well. Yes. The 30 Years' War has just concluded and so on. So is there any sense that the kind of heightened religious tension in Western Europe, is this connected with that in any way? Or would you see these really as kind of separate phenomenon?
No, I think there's definitely a connection of with why the Russian Orthodox Church chose this juncture to reform. In the nearby Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, the Catholic Counter-Reformation was particularly strong, was under full way, and what one of the things they had done in the 1580s and 1590s was to create the Unia, the Uniate Church, or otherwise known as the Greek Catholic Church, which was to offer the Orthodox believers membership of the Catholic Church as in such a way that they'd be allowed to maintain their Orthodox liturgical behavior. So this spirit of sort of trying to reform the Orthodox Church was very much generated by a need to compete with the Catholic Church in Poland and with their new sort of uniate experiment, which was spreading very strongly at the time in the territories which later became Ukraine.
Well, I suppose in context of that, then I suppose you might still be, you know, talking about during the time of troubles when the theory was that, the first false Dmitry was a kind of Polish Catholic tool I suppose those kinds of arguments might have still been around by the mid-1600s, huh?
Certainly. I think really this is definitely an era of heightened confessional and international tension with the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. It's, remember, this in the 1650s, who precisely is the Muscovite state going to war with, but, you know, Poland-Lithuania.
I hadn't quite thought about it in that way before, but yeah, that makes sense. So now that we've kind of, you know, looked at some broad background of the schism that happened, I think now we're kind of in a position to actually talk about what your book is actually about. I think probably it'd be good for you to just talk about, so what was the Edina Venerea? What were the forces behind its creation and implementation? And kind of like, what problem is it trying to solve, I guess?
Sure. Well, I think really we need to look at the roots of the issue, which emerged in the 1760s, when first Peter III and then his wife, Catherine II, came to power. And they were, both figures were moved by a spirit of toleration, both out, well, for in Catherine's case, both out of adoption of the ideals of the French and German Enlightenments, but also for pragmatic reasons, a need to bring all believers out of hiding, out of exile, and to settle them in sort of Russia's expanding empire, especially as it moved southwards towards the Crimea and into what was then called Novorossiya. And so Catherine really took sort of put the brakes on persecution of the old believers and extended to them a great deal of toleration. So they were able to come out of hiding significantly for the first time without any real threat of persecution from the state. This allowed them to found, for instance, their extremely large centers in Moscow, the Preobrazhenskaya Cemetery and the Rogozhskaya Cemetery. This forced the Russian Orthodox Church to find a way of translating Catherine's policy into theological terms. And the major figure here was Platon Lovshin, who was initially the court preacher for Catherine and the tutor for her son and later Tsar Paul, and then became the Metropolitan of Moscow, so the second highest ranking member of the Orthodox Church. And in the 1760s, he wrote a widely published pamphlet, widely distributed pamphlet, wherein he essentially said, well, one way we could end this schism is by allowing the old believers to have their own rights within the Orthodox Church. There shouldn't be division over ritual questions, because ritual questions, in his view, are a matter of secondary importance. Peace within the church is more important. So this was the sort of intellectual groundwork. However, when Metropolitan Platon was very skeptical when it came to actually realizing this new idea in practice throughout the 1780s, there were attempts to create such parishes where all believers would be allowed to practice with their old liturgical rite within the Orthodox Church, so long as they swore loyalty to the synodal order and to the emperor. However, Platon was very skeptical towards this and was really only moved by the fact that Catherine and Grigory Potyomkin intervened strongly on behalf of these new old believer parishes within the Orthodox Church, at least for a while, at least while it captured their attention. He continued to be resistant into the 1790s, into the reign of Paul I. But Paul I's interest in trying to settle the old believer question was much more persistent than his mother's had been. And basically, he pushed through Edina Venerea onto the church. Metropolitan Platon was essentially forced to come up with a settlement, a series of conditions, which would create the structure to allow these old believers to exist within the Orthodox Church while practicing their old rites. And it's this settlement which is called Edina Venerea, so the United Faith or Unity in Faith, basically meaning a wing of the Orthodox Church where old believers were allowed to practice their old rites, their pre-Nikonian rites, in union with the Orthodox Church.
So what was Paul I's main motivation then for pushing this through?
And this is a really interesting question, and to be honest, it's still quite difficult to answer in any clear depth. I mean, unfortunately, neither Russians nor Western historians have done a great deal of work on the confessional policies of Paul. He seems to have been very much motivated, as far as we can tell at the moment, by the same sort of ideas that prompted his mother to intervene heavily in the old believer affairs. So the idea of trying to use to bring them out of hiding, to use them as settlers in less than populated regions of the south.
Paul I has never struck me as the kind of person who would be interested in, the abstruse theology or anything. So I find that kind of interesting that it's during his reign that really happens.
Yeah, I would agree completely. I don't think it is quite surprising that this happened in the reign of Paul, because this is not the kind of policy he's usually associated with. And certainly I don't think he was much one for abstract theologizing. But this was really seen as a way sort of to avoid, Yedinaviria was seen as a kind of way to avoid a contradiction. At the under Catherine and continuing under Paul and Alexander, what the Russian state had done for many other confessions, for instance, the most particularly the Muslims, was to essentially create a sort of institution which and to legalize, if you like, toleration, to basically offer them to extend them toleration through a legislative and institutional framework. However, this couldn't really be done in the case of old belief, because old belief was quite predicated on its opposition to the Orthodox Church. And the Orthodox Church was, of course, the ideological wing, if you like, of the Russian state. So Yedinaviria was a way to try and institutionalize a tolerant attitude to old belief within the church without actually ever having to completely legalize it, completely tolerate it.
So could you talk for a bit then about what forms this toleration was supposed to take in practice, like, intermarriage, how do these rituals actually look and so on?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I mentioned, the sort of foundational document for Yedinaviria was the so-called Rules of Metropolitan Platon, which really established the kind of administrative structure, but also the their liturgical framework and their relationship with the broader Orthodox Church. And there were numerous ways in which these rules both try to integrate the Yedinaviria, as the members of Yedinaviria were called, to integrate them more strongly into the Orthodox confession, while also keeping them at arm's length. So Platon really seems to have believed that once they joined the Orthodox Church, over time it would be best if they eventually abandoned their old rituals. And there seems to have been a direction in the rules which was aimed at this kind of notion of ritual assimilation, to bring the Yedinaviria, so that the members of Yedinaviria would eventually lose their old rituals and become distinct in nothing from the rest of the Orthodox Church. However, at the same time, there were various safeguards, if you like, that Platon instituted to sort of prevent these old believer converts from potentially, becoming being a fifth column within the Church, using their new position to sort of secretly proselytize among the Orthodox. So, for instance, Orthodox people who are members of the Orthodox Church, could not convert to Yedinaviria. They could not join Yedinaviria, even though both things were technically part of the Orthodox Church. If you were Orthodox, you could not join Yedinaviria. This also was the case of if you married, you could intermarry with an there could be intermarriage between an Orthodox and a someone from Yedinaviria. But that didn't mean that the Orthodox person became a Yidin of Eretz or a Yidin of Erka. And there were various other things. So, for instance, a Yidin of Eretz, a priest, was not allowed to attend Orthodox ritual needs apart from in cases of extreme needs. So basically a case where people are at death's door. These basically set the foundation for how Yidin of Eretz developed in practice on the ground for most of the rest of the period, basically creating this interplay between integration and exclusion into and from the Orthodox confession. So, for instance, there were continued debates about what it meant to marry, what a marriage meant between someone from Yidin of Eretz and an Orthodox person. Could there be intermarriage between someone from Yidin of Eretz and old belief? Various answers were put up to this across the 19th century without really anything being too conclusive. There were questions about, for instance, what faith should the child be raised in? Again, this provoked a great deal of debate on many different occasions. Generally, the idea was that the child should be considered Orthodox in all cases. So if one of the partners was Orthodox, then they should be raised within Orthodoxy. There were questions of joint burial and so on and so forth. But also from the sides of the Yidin of Eretz themselves, many of them converted to Orthodox to Yidin of Eretz under duress. And so many of them maintained their loyalty to they maintained their view on the reformed ritual that the Orthodox used. So many, for instance, attempted to attain separate church buildings, separate chapels from the Orthodox, believing that somehow the Orthodox ritual would, the Nikonian ritual, would contaminate the buildings. Many of them tried to attain separate cross processions to have cross processions where they would march separately because they did not want to see the Orthodox ritual, and they regarded the Orthodox ritual as a form of potential religious contamination. In terms of how a typical Yidin of Eretz church service would have looked, well, very much similar to that of a priestly old believer service, so an old believer service where they still maintained a belief in the necessity of the priesthood. So this would have been crossing with two fingers rather than three, maintaining having icons that didn't represent saints from after the schism. So they didn't really want to recognize saints made by the Orthodox Church after the schism. There are records of Yidin of Eretz rejecting electric lighting in churches in the early 20th century. One particular thing that people did note was that the Yidin of Eretz were very, very strict about the liturgy being performed to its full length. So it was noted that services were much longer and much more strict in terms of their accordance with the church regulations about how liturgies were to be performed. So there were far less abbreviations, attempts to reduce the length of the service and so on and so forth. And possibly one other thing that would be very notable would be the fact that the Yidin of Eretz maintained the very distinctive form of old believer singing, so monophonic chanting, rather than the Orthodox polyphonic singing, which was generally introduced in the late 17th century as a result of contact with Roman Catholic Baroque singing from Europe.
So it occurs to me here that it might be a good time for you to talk a bit about the difference in between the old believer communities with priests and those without, and sure, and how you ended up as one or the other.
By the end of the 17th century, basically, there had been a division between old belief, between the priestly and priestless old believers. So the priestly old believers argued that the priesthood was still necessary, so that they still needed to have priests to conduct the liturgical their liturgical life, to perform the sacraments, basically. And they generally obtained them through various ways. Most of them were sort of priests who were fleeing from the Orthodox Church itself, the official Orthodox Church, for one reason or another. Often criminality was involved. They also had sort of training centers, but of course their major problem was that no bishops joined the old believers in the initial schism. So that meant they had no one who could ordain new priests. So really their only sort of source was to turn towards the those priests who had already been ordained by Orthodox bishops, had fled the Orthodox Church, and then usually to conduct some kind of cleansing ritual or some sort of rebaptism in some cases. The other side of the coin is the priestless old believers, who argued, well, the Nikonian rituals have marked the end of Christianity, not only in Russia, but in the world. The Antichrist is now abroad. This means that we have to wait for the second coming of Christ for the reinstitution of the priesthood. So until that time comes, we will rely on members of our own community to perform two of the sacraments, for two of the sacraments allowed by the that can be performed by lay people by the Gospels, which are baptism and penance. This, of course, meant that they couldn't have religious marriages because their lay leaders were not allowed to perform such marriages. Some communities responded to this by essentially abjuring sex and procreation, adopting people from the outside when it came time to sort of try and restore their numbers, while others came to a sort of arrangement to basically conduct civil weddings. And that's really, the biggest distinction between the two would be, of course, in liturgical terms, would be the fact in a priestly old believer church, you would have, of course, a priest conducting the full service. Whereas in a priestless old believer church, you would have a member of a lay community who would do this, and it sometimes could be a woman.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, this is getting us slightly far afield, but I think people might be interested in this. There's still, I think, isn't there even an old believer community or two still up in Alaska?
There is some in Pennsylvania, actually, in Erie.
Okay. Just occurs to me that, if people are kind of that on their own without much of a hierarchy, how if you went to an old believer service now, whether it's, in Russia or in Pennsylvania or wherever, how consistently have practices stayed the same, over such a long period of time, or have they evolved quite a bit since then?
Oh, of course. Old believer communities often, at least the ones sort of outside in the countryside, often isolated themselves from what they regarded as the fallen world. They didn't take much for them to believe other old believers could be fallen as well, which meant that they were quite isolated, and often liturgical traditions, social traditions, social behaviors often evolved quite a lot over time, which meant it was quite difficult when the old believers finally sort of got the capacity in the early 20th century to try and sort of publicly unite. It was very difficult to introduce any unity between the old believer confessions, if you like, the old believer denominations, because there was so much diversity in how the rite was being performed. And of course, when it came down to deciding, well, what was and what wasn't the true ritual, the true custom, where there was a great deal of problems about formulating, you know, the correct blueprint, which old text, which pre-schism text should be used, in what edition, and so on and so forth. So absolutely, there has been a great deal of divergence within old belief in terms of what is regarded as being correct and what is not. And that has only been added to by the experience of the Soviet era, when the old believers were heavily persecuted under Stalin, and led to, in many ways, the destruction of some of the generational transmission of some of their practices, which have meant they've had to be almost reinvented in modern Russia, in post-Soviet Russia.
So, kind of winding our way back to the central thread here, then, I guess I would be correct then in assuming that it's largely the priestly old believers who join Yedina Veria, right?
This is an interesting question, because there's no real clarity on this question, on this matter. On some occasions, it does seem that basically it varies. It varies very much locally. In some cases, there were more old priestly old believers who joined, but in other cases, it was more priestly. And the Orthodox Church never seems to have been to a particularly targeted one group over the other. I mean, just to speak a bit more about this, I mean, possibly the most famous Yedina Verets of the 19th century was a convert monk called Pavel Prusky, so-called because he'd run a priestless old believer monastery in Prussia. He was priestless, and he certainly drew up his appeals to members of the priestless community.
That's interesting. One would have thought that if you regarded the Church of the Era as the Antichrist and didn't need priests at all, that you wouldn't find any people from that point of view joining the Yedina Veria Church. But that is interesting.
Well, if I can just comment, one of the supposed major lures of Yedina Veria is it's saying to the old believers, look, we have now a priesthood who can use the old ritual perfectly legally, perfectly within the church. And now you can have a proper priesthood back. And this was the idea. This was the idea of saying to them, to the priestless, you yourselves must realize that the gospels say a priesthood is necessary, that you need a priesthood. Clearly, we are not the church, we are not the Antichrist. And we can offer you this priesthood who will performed by the rituals that you love so much, and you know you'll be able to have a priest who will perform by those rituals, and you'll be able to use the pre-schism books that you adore so much, all legalized, all fine. So this was the basic idea behind why Yedina Veria would be able to reach out not only to the priestly old believers, but also to the priestless.
So would it be accurate to kind of sum up at this point by saying that the Orthodox hierarchy predominantly views it as a way to get old believers to quit being old believers, whereas old believers look at it as a way to keep right on being old believers?
That's precisely it. Yes, exactly. I mean, this is the conclusion that, well, even at the time when but throughout the century, which most of the Orthodox hierarchy started to realize is that really, you know, many of these people were there because this is essentially legal old belief. This is a form of legalized old belief. And it became rapidly obvious that Platon's hope that they were going to give up this old ritual eventually never really came to pass. So basically there is this constant clash of views between what is the purpose of Yedina Veria. For these old believer converts, it is precisely a sort of way of continuing to practice the old rites legally. For the Orthodox hierarchy, it really is a missionary weapon, first and foremost, for most of the period of the time of its existence.
I think maybe now what might be most useful is to kind of look at this phenomenon in some successive historical eras. It looked to me like there was, you know, quite a bit of persecution of old believers and so on during the reign of Nicholas I between 1825 and 1855. You could talk a bit about what happens in this kind of three-way relationship during that period.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Well, Nicholas I basically launches a persecution against the old believers, which really sort of reaches an intensive scale in the 1840s and 1850s, partially in response to developments within the world of old belief. In 1846, some of the priestly old believers are able to finally find an Orthodox hierarch, a rogue Greek metropolitan, who will basically ordain priests for them, and not only that, but make bishops. So basically they create an old believer hierarchy, an old believer episcopal hierarchy, which subsequently became known as the Bella Konitsia hierarchy, after the place where the ordination of the bishops took place, or more pejoratively as the Austrian denomination, because the ceremony took place within the territory of the Austrian Empire, within Romania, in fact. So this was one of the main reasons where Nicholas I really ramps up what was already a fair amount of suspicion and attempts to sort of attack old belief. And really Nicholas I goes, he seizes old believer churches, he seals them, he takes property away, he closes some of the major centers of old belief. For instance, the Rogozhsky Cemetery in Moscow had its altars sealed, so they could no longer be used. In the case of the priestless Vyg monastery in the north, one of the centers of old believer, a priestless old believer culture, that was seized and destroyed, mostly burnt down. Many old believer priests were arrested and threatened with exile. Many old believer leaders among the merchant community were threatened with losing their status as merchants. And basically what then the government did was say, well, if you won't join Orthodoxy, then maybe you'll join Yedinoviria as the alternative to losing your property, as the alternative to having your churches all closed, as the alternative to having your priest exiled and sent away. So here we see what happens is, as old belief, as the persecution against old believer intensifies, more and more of them convert to Yedinoviria, and Yedinoviria reaches an unparalleled size because of this, because of the persecution. Basically, it never grows as much as it does during as it did during the reign of Nicholas I.
So at that level, then I guess it'd be appropriate to see the persecution of the old believers as really kind of an extension of the Russification program and the official nationality policy, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for Nicholas, loyalty was defined as being a member of the official Orthodox Church, and these, you know, of course, part of the official nationality policy was precisely this focus on the primacy of Orthodoxy, of membership within the church. And for Nicholas, the sheer fact that these all believers existed outside the church was a symbol of disloyalty, not both to himself, so therefore to autocracy, but a betrayal of Russian nationhood, of Narodnost. And this, of course, was confirmed by the fact, at least in Nicholas I's view, when the all believers got their episcopal hierarchy, they did so on the territory of the Austrian Empire, right, and with some degree of the Austrian government's connivance.
So I suppose you could say that continuing to be an old believer offended all three wings of the official nationality policy.
Absolutely, yes, absolutely.
Huh. This is a total aside, but I've always been, I can never repress a chuckle when I recall that Nicholas's official nationality policy was originally drafted in French. I mean, that's hilarious. I hadn't run across that little tidbit until 4 or 5 years ago, and that's fantastic.
Absolutely.
Could you talk a bit about what you called the circular epistle episode in your book?
Yeah, sure. So basically, when Alexander II takes over in 1855, the pace of Nicholas's persecution is almost immediately sort of drawn back, and steps begin to be taken slowly but surely to sort of extend some kind of toleration to the old believers. There's a foundation of a committee which eventually produces two key pieces of legislation. One in the 1870s, which allows the old believers to keep their own metrical books. So in other words, to allow the old believers to keep their own records of their births, marriages, and deaths. This is a really big step because it basically legitimizes old believer marriage, which Nicholas I had banned in the early 1830s. He had delegitimized old believer marriages and therefore threatened sort of inheritances and so on and so forth. And the other major step came shortly 2 years after the assassination of Alexander II in 1883, when a law was passed which basically allowed the old believers to have, once again, sort of have public buildings of worship. They couldn't be advertised as public buildings of worship, but they could have their chapels, their churches, so long as the services were conducted inside and they weren't obviously modeled after Orthodox churches. Now, in response to this more sort of tolerant approach, the priestly old believer hierarchy, the Episcopal hierarchy, tries also to adopt a more conciliatory approach to the government, sort of back away from some of the supposed extremities of their belief. And one of the results of this was the so-called circular epistle, which was distributed from the All Believer Hierarchs in Moscow, from one of their councils, among their believers, which said, well, look, we don't believe the Orthodox Church really is the Antichrist. We don't believe the Russian state is the Antichrist. And they basically said, oh, okay, this is, in most ways, the Orthodox Church believes in the same God as we do. They confess to the same Jesus Christ. Their sacraments have the same life-giving force, etc., etc. But this caused a split among the Episcopal hierarchy. So basically you had one side becoming were in favor of the letter. This was the biggest side. They managed to retain most of the bishops, most of the monasteries, most of the merchanthood. But there was also quite a large section who rejected the letter, who said, we can't go back on this sort of opinion of the Orthodox Church that it is of the Antichrist or is a servant of the Antichrist or some sort of variation of that opinion. And so this split between the only recently created Episcopal hierarchy lasts basically until the end of the empire. And it has numerous consequences for sort of how the Russian Orthodox Church treats it in Iberia in the 1860s and 1870s.
I thought it was interesting that it's kind of the late era of Alexander II where all of this toleration emerges. Since, I mean, normally, you know, Alexander II's reign is, you know, kind of seen as the liberal phase as being before the Karakozov's assassination attempt in 1866, whereas the latter part of his reign is seen as a little more a little more reactionary. So it's interesting that as far as the old believer schism goes, it's really in the latter part of his reign when there's more toleration. That's kind of an exception to what seems to be kind of the general evaluation of his reign.
Sure, I would agree with that. I mean, part of the reason is simply the legislative committee in charge of sort of extending rights to the old believers, but also dealing more broadly with issues of religious toleration to other groups, particularly the issue of what to do with the the situation in the Baltic states, where in the Baltic provinces, where a large number of Lutherans had converted to Orthodoxy in the 1840s, and many of them were trying to sort of drift back to Lutheranism in the 1860s. All these issues were combined together, and it really took Pyotr Vauliev in particular a long time to untwine these issues and get them through the sort of various political opposition to these moves. And it should be noted that the Russian Orthodox Church was mostly an opponent.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but it looked to me like from reading your book that maybe by the middle of the 1880s, it looked like, at least legally speaking, Orthodoxy and Yedina Veria were more or less co-equal. Is that right?
De facto, yes. Basically, by the 1880s, the Russian Orthodox Church, partially in response to these liberal measures of the state, had decided to try and integrate the Yedina Veria more solidly within the confession, so to bring down these various blockades between the two groups. So they started to say, for instance, well, you can go to a Yedina Veria priest for the sacraments if you want to, for instance. And they also began to say, well, they introduced a time period. So if you were Orthodox, you could convert to Yedina Veria if you hadn't been to a sacrament at first in 10 and then within 5 years. So they were trying to bring down these sort of barriers between the two. And indeed, in 1886, they passed a secret edict which said to the bishops throughout the empire that if someone applies to join from Orthodoxy to Yedina Veria, you should just let them. But the problem, of course, is this was a secret edict, and many consistories, in fact, ignored it. they essentially, because it gave the bishops and consistories discretion. There wasn't really in the matter. And many bishops and consistories continue to have a very suspicious or low view of Yedina Veria. But certainly on an official level, on a synodal level, there was the idea of trying to integrate Yedina Veria into Orthodoxy, therefore respond to the liberal measures of the state. So basically to answer some of the criticisms of Yedina Veria's position that had emerged from both within Yedina Veria and from within old belief, and by doing so, counteracting these sort of waves of people going back to old belief. Now it had a better position, basically.
I was laughing because I was imagining somebody who, would want to convert to the Yedina Veria, but if the edict is secret, they wouldn't know that that was allowed.
Oh, absolutely, yes. But I mean, it was for many people the. You find that they defined how they believed, what their identity was very much by ritual behavior, not by the sort of whether they were put into one metrical book or another, whether they were listed as Orthodox officially. Rather, they defined themselves as being old believer because they used the old believer rituals, and therefore they said, "Well, I want to. I'm an old believer, therefore I should be allowed to join Yedina Veria," where, of course, the consistory, holding very close to the letter of the law, would say, well, in fact, you took confession 3 years ago, so you're Orthodox. So you can't join Yedina Veria.
Kind of while we're roughly muddling around in the latter 19th century here, you discussed something in the book that I found kind of interesting when you linked old belief with the kind of emerging nationalism of the latter 19th century. So what I was wondering is, can we kind of see old belief then as a kind of late game Slavophilism in the latter 19th century? Does that become linked up with the idea of Russianness and so on that goes back to the Slavophilism of the 1840s?
Absolutely. And if you look in the 1840s, even there were numerous both Slavophiles and future Slavophiles who were involved in some way with the government's investigations into old belief. For many of them, what they thought they discovered was a group of people who had, because they had broken away from the Russian church and the Russian state in the 17th century, so before the westernizing reforms of Peter the Great. These people were, a unique treasure trove of uncontaminated Russianness, uncontaminated Russian values. and maybe by giving them greater toleration, but also by sort of trying to co-opt them, these kind of values could be restored to the Russian state of then the Russian society of the late 19th century. I mean, absolutely, they do start to be viewed very much through a Slavophile lens.
So in that context, then, when people looking at old believers in the way you've just described, when they look at Yedinoveria parishes, like, do they see those people as kind of nationally suspicious characters?
No, for many, in fact, Yedinoveria becomes a kind of, how would you say, a much more acceptable way of putting this, because, of course, the Yedinoveria were already, you know, they were people who preserved this, you know, ancient ritual compact, etc. They'd preserve this all-believer identity, but we're doing so within full and legal union, and legal in both senses of legislative legality and canonical church legality. So these were people who could potentially be a vehicle for bringing these Russian values back into modern or late 19th century, early 20th century Russian society. Certainly, that's how many Yedinoveria viewed the question.
That's interesting. That occurred to me that, you know, if we the linkage between old belief and nationalism might present some problems, but that's interesting that was the tack that they took. excuse me. I think moving ahead here again in time, could you talk a bit then about the general effects of the 1905 Edict of Toleration?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, basically, of course, well, in the 1905 Toleration Edict, the old believers were given most of the rights of the other Christian confessions. So basically, they jumped up from being semi-legal or kind of legal up to being fully legalized. So they received all the same rights as the Lutherans had, for instance, the Catholics, the Armenian Gregorians, etc. So now all belief is now a fully legalized religious group. So what the Orthodox Church expects is going to happen, and what does happen in at least some dioceses, is that many of the Yedinoveria start to convert back to the to old belief, so return to old belief. And of course, one of the major provisions I should have mentioned of the Toleration Edict was it essentially abolished the law prohibiting apostasy. So now the Yedinoveria could freely go back to old belief without worry of being subject to criminal prosecution. And this causes many other consequences for the Yedinoveria as well. One instance is financial and material. So one engine of Yedinoveria's financial position throughout the 19th century was their typography, their publishing house in Moscow. Because all believers weren't allowed to have their own books, they could only buy them from the typography. Well, this meant that basically the typography did really big business, while the all believer press was censored, while all believers were prohibited from owning their own the books that they'd manufactured or produced themselves. With the Edict of Toleration and the October Manifesto, all believer publishing becomes very legal. The bottom falls out of the printing presses model, which means one of the major sources of donations for church construction suddenly goes away. And there's a real crisis by about 1910 of the Yedinoveria saying, how are we going to fund our schools? How are we going to fund our churches, our charitable institutions without this typography generating income from the formerly persecuted old believers? Another angle to look at is, in fact, this angle of seized property which had been seized from the old believers in the 19th century and had been given to the Yedinoveria afterwards. The old believers now start to try and get some of it back. The government actually goes to some small steps to try and make that happen. Many Yedinoveria are very concerned about their property being taken, what they now view as their property being taken away and given to their people they view often as their religious or community enemies. And there, of course, and possibly the most major consequence is there's a real evaluation of the role of Yedinoveria, its raison d'etre, why does Yedinaviria exist? Does it exist as a missionary weapon against the old belief, or is it something else? Is it a way, perhaps, of creating a bridge for reconciliation between the Orthodox Church and the old believers? So basically, the crisis of confronting a fully legalized old belief makes many start to question about redefining the purpose of Yedinaviria for late Tsarist Russia, for late Imperial Russia.
So, could you talk for a bit then about the revolutionary era? You know, how does that affect our sense of the purpose of this third way in between?
Yeah, sure. So basically, after 1905, this way had been championed, this sort of new vision of Yedinaviria, this vision of Yedinaviria as a means of reconciling with old belief, grounds for mutual reconciliation between old belief and orthodoxy, and also as a vehicle to restore true 17th century Russian piety to the Orthodox Church, had been championed by a group of reformers centered around the St. Petersburg priest, Father Simeon Shliov, who had led this very intensive campaign to try and get these reforms passed for Yedinaviria, to try and essentially abolish the rules of Platon, for instance, and create a new series of rules. Now, he was opposed very strongly between 1905 and 1912 by the members of the Orthodox missionary movement, who held, in fact, no, there's no need to redefine the purpose of Yedinaviria. It's, you know, it's a missionary tool. That's its main goal. That's its main aim. Everything else secondary to that aim. There was some common ground between the two groups, but personal differences and polemical battles basically hardened the positions into almost two irreconcilable camps. Now, in 1912, Shliov lost most of his supporters within the episcopate, because partially as a consequence of the rise of Rasputin and the removal of some of his key supporters, or the discrediting of his key supporters by Rasputin. In 1917, of course, the imperial regime is washed away. There is no more fear of talking out, and Shliov launches a huge scheme to try and pass his vision of Yedinaviria into law at the 1917-1918 Church Council. But he's very much strongly met in opposition by the leaders of the missionary group, who regard Shliov's plan as almost transforming Yedinaviria into a new schismatic movement within the church. Almost, they view Shliov and his party as being quasi-old believers or crypto-old believers, and this scheme as being emblematic of it. One thing they view particularly harshly is the fact that Shliov proposes a name change for Yedinaviria. He proposes to call it Orthodox Old Belief. And the missionary movement detests the idea that these people could be identified in any kind of way as old believers. They clash in the church council. And basically what comes about in 1918 is the council tries to go for a middle ground between the two groups. So, for instance, one of the things that Shliov really wanted was Yedinaviria bishops. There had never been a Yedinaviria bishop before. There had been one or two attempts to create one in the 19th century, but nothing ever came of it. This was strongly opposed by the missionary movement, who thought, well, maybe these Yedinaviria bishops would just run off to old belief and give them a fully legitimate hierarchy. So what the council did was say, okay, what we'll do is we'll give you suffragan bishops. Yedinaviria suffragan bishops. So these are bishops who are deputies of a diocesan bishop. They don't have the full powers of a bishop, and they're of a full bishop, and they're kept under the supervision of an Orthodox bishop. So in some ways, what you see coming out of the council is, although they make many changes to the structure of Yedinaviria, they finally abolish, for instance, the rules of Platon and create a new settlement. Many ways, this dynamic between attempts to incorporate the Yedinaviria while also keeping them arm's length because of suspicion is still incorporated into the new set of rules.
So, So we got time for a couple of more thoughts here. Sure. I was kind of stepping back from your book and thinking about the big picture here. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that occurred to me, you know, is there's the old, I think it's often called the state school of Russian historiography, which tends to take the point of view that on any given subject in Russian history, it's really the role of the state that's the one that's really definitive or that really matters. And it occurred to me as I was reading your book that there's kind of a bit of a backhanded support for that argument here, and that it seems like throughout the whole history of Yedinoveria, that it's really the state initiatives that seem to, not only create the thing to begin with, but to dictate what really happens. Am I overreading what you've said in here, or do you think that has some plausibility?
No, I think there's a degree of truth to that. I think especially in the early period, so really sort of running, well, I say early period, I probably mean up until about the end of the 19th century, is the state is intensively interested in this sort of Yedinoveria project. You have Paul the First who creates it, Nicholas the First who absolutely sort of uses it as a missionary tool. Then you have under Alexander III and Pope Bedonosev as the procurator of the synod, and he was intensively interested in the Yedinoveria project. And really, these were the actors who were giving, I think, a lot of the time steam to it, pushing for reforms, pushing for change. Because basically, as far as I can see, is the Orthodox Church was almost consistently, up until about the beginning of the 20th century, consistently suspicious of Yedinoveria, never really wanted the project to begin with, and remained circumspect about its value, about what it brought into the church. And in many ways, their policies always seem to remain reactive, not only reactive to what the state did, but also what happened in the world of the old believers. I would say that I think really what changes in by 1905 is the most of the state has lost interest with the legalization of old belief. The state loses any kind of interest it has in the movement, and there's no real sign anymore of state intervention in its affairs. Certainly, they partake in key ceremonies and so on and so forth, such as the Yedinoveria Congress held in St. Petersburg in 1912. There are state actors present, but very much this is sort of the idea of presenting a sort of a vision of unity between the state and the Orthodox Church rather than the state showing any kind of interest anymore in Yedinoveria itself.
The other thing I was thinking about was lots of people, this is your book is going to be brand new territory. Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking about obviously, however, religious schism is not a rare phenomenon. And so I was envisioning, okay, so what kinds of people, might be interested in reading your book, maybe for some insights into the dynamics of other kinds of religious schisms. One that occurred to me, for instance, might be the status of Latin Rite Catholics after the Second Vatican Council in the 60s. Having kind of a tenuous status. So I guess what I'm asking here is, like, who else might be kind of likely interested in reading your book in light of other religious schisms? Are there other schisms where people interested in those might benefit from reading what you've written here about the Orthodox schism?
Sure. I think, firstly, I think one issue I think Yedinoveria, the history of Yedinoveria, really highlights is the way ritual is important in both perpetuating religious schism, perpetuating diverse forms of religious identity. And I think I drew a lot conceptually speaking, from studies done on the Reformation in Europe in the 16th and 17th centuries, looking how ritual is used as a marker of confessional distinction, how it's sometimes used to exacerbate religious tensions, religious conflicts, but also on occasion how people draw away from emphasizing the importance of ritual as a way of trying to create common ground. So there are parallels definitely with what you see within Russian Orthodoxy from the 17th from the mid 17th century, all the way through with the case of Yedinaya Vera to 1917, and what had gone on earlier and in some ways continued to go on in Europe from the Reformation. I think there are also some other groups. I mean, you mentioned Catholics. Well, of course, the Catholic Church has its own issues of liturgical diversity in the form of the Greek Rite Catholics and the Latin Rite Catholics. And many of the lessons you can sort of regain from a study of Yedinaya Vera have their reflections in the history of the way the Eastern Rite Church is treated within Catholicism. And of course, stretching a bit more, you might also lean to sort of saying, well, which other churches have had difficulties with divides over questions of rituals? And one, of course, that might emerge for an English-speaking audience, for an English-speaking readership, is the experience of the Anglican Church, which, of course, has always tried to have a balance between the high church and low church, between a quite Catholic liturgical settlement and a quite Protestant liturgical settlement. And I think there are some quite interesting parallels, comparisons, distinctions to be drawn from putting Yedinaya Vera and its experience with the Orthodox Church and the Anglican Church's attempts to deal with its two liturgical traditions. There's a good deal of that can be drawn from putting these two things side by side.
I had thought of the Anglican analogy there myself when I was finishing up reading your book. That is an interesting one to me as well. Well, I think we're about out of time here, so thank you very much for enlightening me. Certainly, this was something that I really knew nothing about before I tackled your book. So, thank you for a very interesting read and clarifying a few issues for me here in the course of our chat.
No, thank you very much for having me. It was and thank you very much for your interesting questions. It was a delight.